Welcome to this special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations we've had on The 21st about science and technology. Later this hour, what we're learning about the birth of black holes. And we'll talk about what young evangelical Christians in Illinois want their congregations to do when it comes to climate change. But first, how many of you listening have a food allergy? Maybe your child does. Then you know the anxiety that comes along with this. I'm talking about the constant worry that you or your loved one may take one wrong bite. One analysis of private insurance claims shows that life-threatening allergic reactions to food have increased by 5 times over the last decade. But Illinois scientists are starting to learn about possible solutions. Katherine Nagler is a food allergy researcher and professor at the University of Chicago. Dr. Ruchi Gupta is a professor of pediatrics at Lurie Children's Hospital in Northwestern Medicine. She's also author of the book called The Food Allergy Experience. Lauren Williamson is a senior editor for Chicago Magazine. I talked to all three of them about this issue last fall. Lauren's young son actually has food allergies, and I started by asking her about that.
Yeah, I have a 20-month-old son who, at the time that I wrote the story, we believed he had 3 food allergies, though we have just had his annual blood test results that now we think he's down to 2, so we're moving in the right direction, but he is allergic officially to peanuts and eggs.
And for the parent, what was the number one thing you wanted to learn, Lauren?
The number one thing I wanted to learn, and what actually set me on the path to writing this story, is what can I do to help my son? Because it's such an overwhelming diagnosis when you learn your child has a food allergy, because all of a sudden there are all these foods that that child must avoid. And it's not just peanut butter itself, for example, but it's anything that may come into contact with peanuts at any point during the manufacturing process or with eggs. And so all of a sudden, huge areas of food are completely eliminated from his diet. The range of reactions that could happen could be anywhere from a few hives to a full-blown anaphylactic reaction, and you never know what's going to happen. And so that anxiety is huge. And so then I wanted to know, okay, well, how can I fix this? And I started to learn about all of this research that's going on to help create treatments for food allergies beyond just an EpiPen that would be used in a severe reaction. And I started discovering it, that so much of it was actually coming right out of Illinois and out of Chicago. And so I thought, oh, my gosh, I want to share this with other people, too, all of the stuff that I'm discovering.
Dr. Gupta, Lauren mentioned that anxiety, the dread if you or your child accidentally consumes one of these allergens. And I wonder, I think there are people who are listening who maybe don't have allergies, who don't think about or maybe are not aware of how serious this could be. How serious can this be, and how common is this problem?
Yeah, so food allergies impact about 8% of children. So that's about, you know, 1 in 13 kids, so about 2 in every classroom. And that's why I think we've seen so much more awareness about this, even in schools and everywhere you go. As far as severity, what's so interesting is, you know, kids with food allergy, you know, are, you know, totally fine the majority of time, but there's this intense fear that if they came in contact with their allergenic food, you know, they could have a reaction. And, you know, as Lauren said, that reaction could be mild to, you know, life-threatening. And, you know, in our survey, when we looked at 40,000 kids across the United States, we found that over 40% of them had experienced one of these life-threatening reactions in their life. And about 1 in 5 of these kids were going to the emergency room in the past year for an allergic reaction. So that's what makes it, you know, so difficult, is you don't know when this is going to happen. And food, you know, is a part of everything everyone does, but especially kids. You know, it's a part of 3 meals a day and snacks and play and sports and celebrations. And so I think this is what makes it very difficult for families with food allergy.
It is difficult for families. I know this is a big part of my family and talking to people about this. Lauren, you spoke with one mother who described anaphylaxis as watching her kid drown. And fortunately, you haven't had to experience this, but obviously you're trying to avoid all of these experiences for your child. What kind of steps do you have to take?
Well, whenever we eat out, we have to wipe down the table and the high chair with wipes before we sit my son down, because we don't know what has been on those surfaces before we got there. We have to call manufacturers for any processed foods to find out what their processes are like. Do they have separate lines? What are their cleaning procedures like if they do use shared lines? Because the labeling laws aren't quite as clear-cut as you would hope they would be. So it's not always clear if there's a possibility that an allergen might be in a packaged food. We have made our house a safe zone, so we don't have any of the foods that my son is allergic to in our house, so that we can feel that he has like a place where we can, you know, feel a little bit more comfortable, and we don't have to worry if he just grabs something off the shelf. We've already vetted it. But then at the same time, my husband and I make sure that we continue to eat the foods that he's allergic to when we're outside of the home, because if you start avoiding a food, it's possible to develop an allergy later in life. There are other ways you can develop it too, but that's one of the risk factors, is if you stop eating a food itself. So it's a lot of work, and because it's everything that he puts in his mouth, we have to double check and make sure that it's safe. And we've trained his daycare providers how to spot an allergic reaction, how to properly clean everything that he's in contact with in the daycare. And you know, we're really fortunate we have great partners there, but it's, you know, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of stress.
That's Lauren Williamson. She's a senior editor at Chicago Magazine. Catherine Nagler, Professor Nagler, to bring you into this conversation, you're working on trying to understand why so many people have food allergies these days. And one of the prevailing theories relates to hygiene. I wonder how our immune system, and in particular, how we approach hygiene, relates to allergies these days.
Yes, that's correct. I'd like to probably word it a little bit differently. So what we are seeing is really a generational change. When I was a child, food allergies were relatively rare. Now, as you've already heard from Dr. Gupta, they're fairly common. And the hypothesis is that we've changed our microbiome. That is the trillions of bacteria that live in and on our body, in such a way that we've depleted bacterial populations that are protective against allergic disease. So hygiene comes into the picture because this concept was originally associated with enhanced cleanliness in society, vaccination, and reduced exposure to infectious disease. But it's now clear that it's not removing exposure to pathogens, but changes in our normal bacterial component that are driving what is sometimes called what are sometimes called the diseases of Western society. So not only food allergy, but inflammatory bowel disease, obesity, diabetes, autism, asthma, they're all increasing in parallel. So what are some of these lifestyle factors? Antibiotic use is the primary culprit. Diet is also a very, very big factor. So we have co-evolved with these bacteria over millennia, and our ancestors didn't eat McDonald's. They ate a diet that was very high in fiber, low in processed food, low in dietary fat, and we've changed the food source that the bacteria need to live and multiply in our guts.
And that's why that matters, Professor Nagler, because the we're talking about food that we consume that's important for the bacteria within us?
Sure. They eat what we eat. So if we don't give them the diet that, if we don't give particular populations of bacteria, so let's focus on the allergy protective populations, if we don't give them the food that they need, they're not going to thrive. And it happens that the bacteria that we've identified that are allergy protective are those that are particularly good at fermenting dietary fiber, so breaking down the fiber in our diet to produce molecules that have vital roles in stimulating the immune system and providing maintaining the healthy intestinal barrier and preventing allergic disease.
So we got a question on Twitter from a listener, Mary. She says, please ask these people, I guess our guests here, on behalf of this food allergy mom, what are the 2 to 3 most effective things we can do now for her kids, for their kids? Hers is 14, has a peanut allergy, peanut, tree nut, sesame seeds, plus celiac. That's the problems that she's dealing with. She asked about probiotics, Professor Nagler. She asked about herbs. What do you think in terms of what exists right now?
So there's a lot of controversy about probiotics. Generally, the probiotics that currently exist are yogurt-type bacteria. They've not shown to be effective in the treatment of disease. Whether or not they are helpful in situations of gastrointestinal distress is debatable, but they're not helpful in treating allergy. So what we're trying to do is create, we don't call them probiotics, we call them microbiome modulating therapeutics, of entirely new class of bacteria based on the bacteria that live in the absence of oxygen way deep in our GI tracts. Those are the ones that are important in protection, that according to our studies, and their products are what we need to replace.
And that's what you're studying? That's what you're researching,
yes.
Those?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we formed a startup company called ClusterBio that is actually taking this basic science work into a company so that we can bring it all the way to clinical trials to develop new treatments that will restore the functionality of the bacteria in our gut, not replace the diversity that was present in previous generations. There's not really a realistic way of doing that, but restore the vital functions that have been lost.
Dr. Gupta, as you listen to Professor Nagler talk about the science side of this, what researchers are doing, there's also been some changes. You helped develop the American Academy of Pediatrics new guidelines, I think this was last year, correct, encouraging earlier introduction of potential allergens. Can you remind us what that change looks like?
Sure. You know, in the past, 15, 20 years, the research has really expanded in food allergy. And, you know, there are treatments that are on the horizon coming out, you know, hopefully in the next year to 2 years. But, you know, along with treatments, there's prevention. And this is really important. I'm glad you asked because, you know, as we think about, you know, causes of food allergy, one large study in London found that early introduction of peanuts specifically could prevent food allergy or peanut allergy in infants that are at highest risk. And by high risk, I mean infants that have eczema as infants and severe eczema and or, you know, other allergies, specifically egg allergy. Those infants are at high risk for the development of a peanut allergy. And so this study found that if those infants were introduced to peanut-containing products around 4 to 6 months of age, ideally, their immune system, which is in development, would recognize that food and potentially not develop that allergy. So why this is really important is, you know, parents of newborns, you know, it is so critical that you talk to your pediatrician about this, because if they are an infant with no risk factor, so no eczema, no other allergies, you know, introducing peanut products into their diet early as they start introducing solids is really useful for the prevention, but especially parents of infants who may have eczema and those risk factors, talking to your physician early, getting referred to an allergist and getting appropriate testing, and then potentially introducing peanut products over time in those early months could prevent their development of a peanut allergy. So we're kind of attacking it from both ends. You know, it'd be great to treat all our children, including mine, who has food allergies with these new treatments coming to market, but also can we help to prevent it in the new generation of children?
Dr. Gupta, I did want to end. We just have a minute or two left, but I did want to ask you about that, what you think people don't understand as someone who's both, as you said, a parent who has personal experience and as someone who's the director of science and outcomes of allergy and asthma research for Northwestern. What are you hoping that more people are aware of and understand more about?
Well, for the general public, you know, I really appreciate all the amazing support, you know, for kids with food allergy, you know, being really understanding of the fact that this is not like, you know, an environmental allergy. It's not just going to cause, you know, runny nose and watery eyes, but it could, you know, be life-threatening. It could cause trouble breathing. It could cause a drop in blood pressure, and it could happen very rapidly. So the awareness of the general public that this is a real condition, and it really takes everyone's support, because especially for our children, you know, I think the hardest thing that causes anxiety for families with children with food allergy is they're not in your care most of the time. So you're really depending, especially when your children are very young, and then as they get into the teen years, on their friends to help support them in terms of, you know, being very vigilant in avoiding their allergen.
That's Dr. Ruchi Gupta, professor of pediatrics at Lurie Children's Hospital in Northwestern Medicine. You also heard from Katherine Nagler, a professor and food allergy researcher at the University of Chicago, and Lauren Williamson, a senior editor at Chicago Magazine. I spoke with all three of them last fall. Stay tuned. Coming up after the break, why the issue of climate change is becoming more important for young evangelical Christians, including right here in Illinois. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Democrats across the country and here in Illinois are in broad agreement that we need to drastically cut emissions in order to stop climate change. One of Governor Pritzker's first actions in office, for example, was to join the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a group of states committed to upholding the Paris Climate Accord. But there's a huge divide when it comes to older Republicans and their millennial counterparts. Younger voters are more likely to support pro-environmental policies. The same can be said for evangelical Christian voters. Mira Subramanian wrote about this young crop of evangelicals fighting against climate change for Inside Climate Change News. Diego Hernandez is a student at Wheaton College who was profiled in Mira's piece, and Riley Balikian is a member of the National Steering Committee for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, or YECA. He's also a geophysicist at the Illinois State Geological Survey and a Wheaton grad. I interviewed Mira, Diego, and Riley in December of last year, and I started by asking Riley how he first became passionate about climate change.
It was something that as a kid, I didn't grow up necessarily talking about it or thinking about it much. There was a few formative episodes, I would say. I think one of them was I did an internship abroad in Ethiopia, and a lot of the people there, it's a very rural population, and their livelihood is very dependent upon the natural world. And so seeing that and seeing some of the difficulties that people were dealing with made me much more sensitive to the way that our livelihood is based on the natural world and the climate and the weather around us. And really it was just coming back after that. Wheaton College is a very supportive community in terms of exploring new things and talking about it with different faculty and different students. That was something that I kind of came too late. And actually, in geophysics, I also kind of came too late. And that was kind of in sync, that I was learning more about climate change and about some of the issues we're dealing with, and also developing professionally as a scientist and growing interested in that. They're about the same time period in my life.
Diego, you're a sophomore from Wheaton. You're originally from Texas. I wonder how your experience in your home state influenced your feelings about the environment.
Yeah, well, in Texas specifically, where I'm from and the demographic, climate change isn't really a big issue. Especially as a young conservative, climate change isn't necessarily an issue that we take as not that big of a deal. But not until I came to Wheaton and I went back home, I got to see a lot of things, travel the state, and not until then did I start realizing that climate change should be focused on more, and that it's a much bigger issue than what conservatives are making it.
And so would you say, Diego, that your thoughts about that are reflective of the culture in Wheaton, at Wheaton in general, people being concerned about climate change and wanting to work to fix it?
I do believe so. I'm also part of student government here at Wheaton College, so I'm one of the sophomore class presidents. And this last year, the student government actually voted on adding a new position to student government, which is the executive vice president of campus sustainability. That person's role specifically is focusing on addressing the climate or addressing the environmental issues on campus. So I do believe that it's a very, very strong position that Wheaton College students are taking.
And Diego, I wonder how you think that contrasts with your friends or family, or I'm even thinking of your home church back home in Texas.
I think it's actually a really good step that we're taking right now, because as a Christian and as believers, we're taught to take care of the earth. When the fall of man happened, he told them that your role is to take care of the earth. And I think that that rule is something that God still wants us to follow. So I think that as Christians, it's our calling to make sure that we are taking care of the earth. So I think if you go back home to Texas and you ask anyone, they'll definitely agree. I think it's more of asking the people in office what they're doing about it.
That's Diego Hernandez, who's a sophomore at Wheaton College. We've also been speaking with Riley Balikian, a member of the YECA National Steering Committee and a geophysicist at Illinois State Geological Survey in Central Illinois. We found out about them from Mira Subramanian. She's a reporter for Insight Climate News. We'll tweet out Mira's story about this. But Mira, do you, these sentiments, what Diego and Riley are telling us, does that echo what you found in your reporting when it comes to younger generations of Christians, particularly evangelical Christians?
That's definitely what I found at Wheaton College, and this is kind of a place where this action is really coming from in some regards in terms of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action started out of this area and is expanding across the nation, and so it's still a growing body. I mean, I think I would have found a different story if I'd gone to Bob Jones University, for example, because there is that political affiliation that is such a strong indicator of how people stand on climate change. It actually is, the political affiliation is actually a stronger indicator of what people think about it than religion is.
Riley, I wonder how, as a scientist, your faith informs your science?
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are Christians and scientists will say, and I agree, that the very basics of science is based in Christian thinking, that there's a logic to the world, that there's a creator who is intelligent and we can interpret the world intelligently. I think love for the creation and a moral response, it's not just studying the science, but it's studying the nature. It's a love and a care for the nature that I think informs a lot of my work. I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, a curiosity about things, that's, I think, also something that we get an inspiration of curiosity and wonderment about the world. And I think that for me is coming from my faith. I know other people can get that from other places as well, and that's a large part of the scientific community. But for me, that's very much based in my faith, wanting to know more about God, the creator, as well as God in creation.
And when you guys think about that, Riley and Diego, I wonder, to Mira's point, do you feel like sometimes when you're thinking in evangelical circles, the politics can color that? I wonder how you all manage to overcome maybe political objections to all of this. Diego?
I do think that the politics of certain people's politics may have a role in altering what their opinion might be. I think it's not necessary. I mean, I think conversation has a very, very important role in determining how people view their a new way of thinking about climate change. But when I was talking with Mira, what basically made me start feeling convicted about how we're treating the climate was when I took a trip to the coastal area of Texas, and my mom wanted to take me on the scenic route. And when she took me on the scenic route, it was basically nothing but oil fields, and there was drills everywhere. And I think what basically has to get not only talked about, but also seen by people is that the environment is being affected in many other ways than one. It's not just the fact that we're, you know, drilling everywhere, and people say, oh, well, we're drilling offshore, which is not always true. In many cases, we're drilling on land and pretty far inland. I think that not only do we need to be talking about it, but we need to be showing people the causes or the effects of what's going on.
Oh, I would just say that in addition to political ideology, I don't know that it's fair to to necessarily put all Christians or even all evangelicals in one political camp. I think it's almost a philosophical difference, might be a better way of thinking about it. For Christians, and especially evangelical Christians, and I would include myself in this, the scripture is the ultimate source of truth. And so when you're looking at other truth systems and the claims that they make around the world, whether that's about climate science or, you know, one of the more contentious things has been the origins debate, a lot of that is filtered through how do we understand the world as given to us through scripture? And so, you know, scripture doesn't speak a lot on climate science, so there's probably there may be some politics playing in there as well. But I think for most people, their understanding of the world, for most evangelical Christians, I should say, their understanding of the world is filtered through the lens of scripture.
Mira, I wanted to ask you about something else that you wrote about, which was the idea of pro-life. And the way that you have an interpretation that I think people may not think of when it comes to the environment. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is really interesting that I was just hearing from younger voices, is that there's a whole idea of like a larger idea of intersectionality and social justice issues and how the impacts of climate change are playing out. And that's actually interesting, going to Riley's point of like going back to scripture, is like the idea of caring for the least of these, you know, in the biblical times was widows and orphans. And now places like the National Evangelical Association, which is a huge association that represents like 43 million American evangelicals, they've put out a statement in 2015 saying they accept climate change, they accept that it's human caused, and that there should be action taken. And their argument, fundamental argument behind the reason to take action, is that the people that will be impacted are the people that Riley met in Ethiopia, people who are really vulnerable, who are very, very dependent on the natural resources and the state of, you know, they need farmland that can produce, that gets enough water, that doesn't get too much water, and they need fisheries that their livelihoods depend on. So this whole idea of social justice behind it is something that I was really hearing, and so that extends to the pro-life. I think because the abortion issue has become such a single vote issue for many evangelical Americans, what I heard from many of the students at Wheaton was like, we're thinking about pro-life at all stages of human life, and we're talking about not just the existence of a life, but the quality of that life, that they have the ability to make a living, to make a healthy living, that their children can grow up to be healthy and have opportunities. And so a much, much broader expansion of what it means to be pro-life.
Mira, that said, I wonder if you see climate change becoming maybe a wedge voter issue for young evangelicals. Could that change the way people are voting?
I think that it could. I mean, I just see so much more like those statistics that you were referencing in the beginning of the show about just young people. The reality is that this is going to be their problem more than, you know, I'm in my middle ages and there's people that are older that are in control. And the reality is that the future is going to be a long haul in terms of how these issues are going to play out. And so I think that those Pew polls are reflecting that younger people are more concerned about it. And so I actually do think that it could very much become a wedge issue. And I don't know, you know, if for the Christian right that is concerned about abortion issues, I don't know that the Democratic Party is ever going to adjust their stance on that. But I could see the Republicans, given enough pressure, or young people just being engaged and voting, because they are an amazing political powerhouse, young Americans, if they get out to the polls. I think that they could help influence the Republican Party to perhaps be more active on climate action. And it doesn't have to come from a earthy place. It can come from an economic standpoint, places like Texas that are embracing wind power because it's a good moneymaker. There's jobs and good economic security in heading in that direction as well. So it could become a wedge issue, I believe.
Diego, what about you? I know you weren't old enough to vote in the last presidential election, but how important is climate change in the environment when you're thinking about 2020 or other elected, whether not just president, but other elected officials?
Yeah, it's definitely become a big issue for me. For someone who hasn't grown up and who hasn't like been studying climate change for a decent portion of my life or while I'm in college, it's still a pretty new issue to me. So I'm always trying to learn as much as I can. But definitely seeing what I've seen, hearing, talking with students on campus and talking with Mira, just diving into the issue a lot more, it's definitely becoming a bigger issue for me. And I also believe it's becoming a much bigger issue for students on campus and for young evangelicals. So I really do think that come next election, climate change will be a much bigger issue that's going to be focused on, especially in young people.
And Riley, apart from voting, I mentioned at the beginning that your work with the Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, what kind of things are you guys working on in the near future when it comes to realistic things that individuals can do?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit biased, but I think we have one of the best young leadership development programs I've seen. We have a program called the Climate Leadership Fellows, and these are mostly students, but it's just whoever fits within the young evangelical framework within their communities, doing specific projects to make towards sustainability. And so we have some students that or some young people who are doing recycling programs at their school where there wasn't one before. There's some students that are working in food sustainability. The sustainability student government person that Diego mentioned at Wheaton, that was in part work done by one of our fellows that kind of helped that come about. There's a lot of young people who are doing things in their local communities that's really inspiring, and it's one of the favorite things about my work that I do with YACA is to see the work that they're doing and the ways that they're growing as young leaders in their communities.
And are you expecting to see that happen in churches as well?
Yeah, there have been a few fellows that have been doing work in their churches. It's not as common. I think it's a little bit more, it's a little bit different dynamic trying to work in the churches. I don't think it's impossible. We have another program called the Project Leaders, which is very similar but just structured a little different. And we've had a couple people who have done Bible studies that are based on what does it look like to care for creation? What does it look like to be made in the image of God and to be living that out in the way that we are interacting with the world around us? And so there is action in the churches. There's actions a lot of times at the colleges, whether they're Christian colleges or, public colleges. But I think there's a lot of encouraging work being done by our organization and by other organizations as well, and other students who just are inspired to act on climate.
That's Riley Balikian, who's a member of the YECAs. We've been talking about Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. He's on the National Steering Committee. He's also a geophysicist at Illinois State Geological Survey and a Wheaton College grad. I want to thank current Wheaton student sophomore Diego Hernandez and Mira Subramanian, the journalist who wrote about evangelicals and climate change for Inside Climate News. We'll tweet out Mira's story. But all of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last summer, twin telescopes in Hawaii captured a bright anomaly 200 million light years away. It was there, then it was gone, just as quickly. It turns out that moment might have been a star becoming a black hole. That comes after other news last winter of new gravitational wave detections that help shed light on entire populations of black holes. Shane Larson and Chris Pankow are astrophysicists at Northwestern University who've been studying this. I spoke with both of them back in January, and I started by asking Shane to remind us just what exactly is a black hole.
So black holes come in many flavors in the universe, but the kind of conventional thing that all of us know about is black holes are one kind of skeleton that forms when stars die. You take all the matter that was in the core of a star, something about the mass of our entire solar system, or 5 or 10 times the mass of everything in our solar system, and you squeeze it down to something like the size of a city. And when you do that, the gravity becomes so strong that not even light can escape, which, as you can imagine, makes it very difficult for astronomers to study with things like telescopes.
And so last week, your colleagues at the American Astronomical Society got together to talk about this really exciting phenomenon that I just mentioned. And actually, you guys have a name for this, the birth of the cow, or more accurately, I should say, the black hole AT 2018 COW. First of all, where do these names come from?
So there are standard ways that we name all of these objects, and the conventions for each type of object I don't recall necessarily, but they often go with, you know, some indicator of the telescope that discovered it, some indicator of the year or the time that it happened, and then just a series of increasing indicators of which one was it we discovered. So COW is the kind of increasing indicator part of that. And as you can imagine, remembering that name is really hard. So we just shorten it to COW. And that makes it really easy to talk about and for everyone to know what we're talking about.
Okay. So Chris, Shane, which one of you guys want to tell us about what you guys talked about with the COW last week?
Oh, yeah. I think the really interesting part about all of this was that astronomers and the measurements they've been making kind of pinned it down to two possible scenarios. And one of them is one of the processes that Shane just talked about, a supernova, which then collapsed a dying, very massive star into a black hole or possibly a neutron star. And then the thing that people are trying to figure out there is how or what the interesting interaction of all of this matter that gets thrown off from the supernova was with the medium around that that dying star. So that's one possible theory. And another one is that another type of compact object called a white dwarf, which is something similar to what our sun might turn into at some point, or maybe a little bit more massive than that. But this came too close to what we call an intermediate mass black hole, another member of the zoo of black holes we have, where Shane was talking about solar mass black holes, so 10 or 15 times the mass of the sun. This is something like 100 or 1,000 times the mass of the sun. And the white dwarf zoomed by the intermediate mass black hole, and because of the tidal forces, so the ability of the black hole to stretch out the white dwarf, it was basically ripped apart, and then all of that matter was accelerated and heated and could have produced a very bright flash similar to the supernova. So those are kind of the two theories that astronomers are working with for this event.
And so every time a star dies, does that automatically mean a black hole is born, Shane?
No. So this is why events like this are so interesting to us, is that as astronomers, we really want to understand all the different ways that stars die. And it's only the biggest stars, when they die, that they become black holes. And then kind of little bit lighter weight stars, when they die, they'll make supernovas, but they'll become this other kind of stellar skeleton, which we've talked about before, called a neutron star. And then the third way that stars die is what Chris just mentioned, the so-called white dwarfs. And that's reserved for the lightest stars in the universe, of which our sun is an example.
And so, Shane, it sounds to me, as someone who is not an astrophysicist or an astronomer, that black hole is kind of a more generic term for a class of an event than an actual one thing, right?
Yeah. Black holes come in many different sizes, as Chris alluded to. We have these stellar mass ones that result from stellar death. We have these intermediate mass ones that we think should exist, that we would really, you know, like to exist because it makes sense that they exist, but we've never seen one, so we don't really know if they do. And then there are what we call massive or supermassive black holes, and those live at the centers of galaxies. And there is one at the center of our galaxy, and there's one at the centers of many other galaxies as well. And those are millions and sometimes billions of times the mass of the sun, and where they come from is also a great mystery.
So, Chris, this stellar death that Shane was just referring to, is that what you guys, or that was what was observed in these telescopes last summer, perhaps?
Yes, it is. It's a very distinct possibility. So it leads back to one of the primary theories. So the supernova is the type of thing that takes you from having the dying star that we can still see, and then it undergoes a supernova, and it throws off a bunch of its outer layers, but the you know, very, very dense core that's left over isn't able to support itself against gravity anymore, and it could collapse into a black hole. So one of the ways that people reveal what they call the central engine in the supernova is to do the types of measurements of the spectrum of the light that's coming from these and correlate that back to how we know the supernova works, or we don't know the supernova works. So that's one of the things that's pretty exciting about this particular sort of peculiar event.
So we're speaking to Shane Larson, who teaches physics at Northwestern University, and Chris Pankow, who's a postdoc fellow at Northwestern's University and works with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration Research Group. Chris, can you remind us what LIGO is, how many different scientists are studying this and working together to help improve our understanding of these things?
Sure. So we have a collaboration of well over 1,000 people over about 100 or so institutions really around the world. And they together operate, we're pushing towards a fourth right now, but we have three operating what we call interferometers. And these are mile-long Ls, I guess I would call them, that basically we use lasers to hear black holes. And the basic idea is that we shoot a laser down the interferometers, both arms of the L, and when it comes back, it should be in a very particular state, and we combine that into that state. And if we find that it's not in that state, in other words, that it doesn't add together in the right way, then we infer from that that a gravitational wave has passed by, thereby stretching one arm versus the other, changing the state of that light as it comes together at the center, and allowing us to measure things like gravitational waves.
Did you say you try to hear things, Shane? Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, so this is one of the difficulties that we gravitational wave astronomers have, which is, how do you describe what we're doing? All of us are kind of used to describing the universe in terms of our senses. We see things, we hear things, we feel things with our sense of touch, or we smell things. But gravitational waves are a physical phenomena that your body is not designed to detect. As I like to tell people, you don't have a gravitational wave detector in your elbow. And so when we talk about what we're doing and what we're measuring, we are decidedly at a lack of words to describe what we're measuring. We can say measure and detect all we want, but it doesn't have that kind of same visceral feel that we as humans associate with describing things in terms of our senses. So you will hear us say see things in gravitational waves or hear things in gravitational waves, but that's not really what we're doing. We're detecting gravitational waves using lasers and these interferometers and these instruments that we've built.
And so they don't actually make sounds that we could hear.
They don't make sounds, but we can transform the data into sounds so that you can better understand, experience, perceive, think about what our data is and what it represents in terms of what the universe is doing.
So I know that, so Chris, what does it sound like, or what, when you're, the kind of data that you're looking for, is there a particular sound you're going for?
So it's a very distinctive sound, and it's interesting because one of the reasons we say hear is because the frequencies of the gravitational wave are very similar to human hearing frequencies. So when we transform the data, for binaries, it's a very, very distinct sound that we call a chirp, and it sounds like a whoop. So it starts at low frequency and then very quickly ascends to a high-pitched frequency and then just ends when the two objects merge.
I wonder, LIGO, I know, as well as a couple other observatories, are planning to do a third observation run early this year. Chris, what are you guys hoping to collect or data to observe this year?
So We now know, so we've detected binary black holes, we've detected binary neutron stars. There's a third class of event that mixes the two, a black hole and a neutron star. There's an outside chance that we could detect one of those during O3, though we're not, the prospects there are not as good. We know we're going to see probably or hear tens of binary black holes, maybe a handful of binary neutron stars. And there's other more exotic phenomena. So gravitational wave detectors are sensitive to supernovas as well. We just can't hear them nearly as far away as telescopes can see them. That would be a very exciting event if it were to happen, and we think the telescopes would also see that because it would be within our galaxy. Also a rare event. And then there are a few other types of exotic sources, such as an isolated neutron star that has a slight deformity on it. And if that neutron star is rotating in a certain way, then we would detect sort of what we call monochromatic gravitational waves, which is just gravitational waves at a single frequency.
So we'll start up in April right now is the current plan. And the difference between what we've done before and what's going to happen in April is that every time we shut down and start up again, we go into the detectors, we kind of tune them up, we improve them a little bit. So we're going to be able to see much farther into the universe than we were in our previous observing runs. And so what you heard Chris say, we're going to see more of all of these objects and possibly more exotic ones, is purely a function of that ability to see farther than we have been able to see before.
And when you're seeing these things, Shane, you've been able to deduce from this that almost all of the black holes share kind of similar properties, especially when it comes to weight. Why is it important to know that?
So this is part of this attempt on our part as astronomers to understand how black holes form and how stars die. One of the unusual things that LIGO has uncovered is there are bigger black holes, heavier black holes, than we would have reasonably expected going into this game. And as astronomers, when we think about stellar life and stellar death, that's really important because it's part of the story of how stars lead their lives and how one generation of stars leads to the next stars and so on. From the perspective of me and you and those of us sitting around the kitchen table listening to this broadcast, you know, it's like, why do we need to know about the lives of the stars? You know, this is part of the journey to understand where you and I and all the stuff of us came from. And the lives of the stars is the beginning of that story. So it's all kind of intertied together, and catching that thread and kind of understanding how it's all linked is kind of one of those big brain melting things that takes a long time to understand and come to grips with.
And
even
so,
for us.
Right. Well, so for those of us who are not you guys, it sounds like the news of all of this information, especially over the past month, is pretty exciting when it comes to black hole news.
Yeah, I'd say we're giddy. That's a good word. It's these times, you know, when you start in astronomy, when you're a student, you're just going to college, you decide, oh, I'm going to be an astronomer. You read about times like this when you talk about the history of astronomy. And, you know, it's kind of part of the folklore of the way our field came to be. And it's kind of something remarkable to live through it and be a part of it.
Well, thanks for sharing all of that with us. That's Northwestern University Shane Larson and Chris Pankow. Guys, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It was great being here.
Does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.